my time doing over the last few years, and it's been an absolute gold mine in terms of new results. So just so you know, I'm going to be giving four talks, and the main goal of the talks, and so what I promised to give you in the last couple talks, is a simple, should take no more than about five lines, depending on how you count, BCFW recursion implementation of the all loop of all three amplitudes in n equals four. That's 10,000 times faster or so than the code that's publicly available. So that's the goal. And to get there, though, we really need to cover some of the foundations of Mathematica. And I understand that while most of the audience is probably pretty familiar with everything in Mathematica, some of the audience less so. And so today's talk is much more geared towards the big picture, the pedestrian, the introduction, getting things started. And in that spirit, I wanted to start in the very early days of computing. And so I found this book recently, which from the very early days of computing. Can anybody read Latin? It's from this Professor Jean Cor. He's a professor of philosophy and mathematics and published in The Hague in 1762. Anybody tell me what this book's about? What? Yeah, nature. But that occurs in every title of those books this time. Trigonometric, good. Triangular. So the book starts off with a 30-page introduction to the theory and practice of triangular numbers, and then has so here's the first page of the book. You have the first triangular number is 1, the second one is 3, then 6, 10, 15, 21, okay? And then he goes on like that for 224 pages. Okay? So the 19,991st triangular number is that. And there are about 3 pages of errata at the beginning of the book, so somebody actually proofread this. So remember that you could have, you know, had a worse advisor. this is, of course, hilarious from today, because any one of us, you know, we have iPhones with us, or we have calculators, we have our laptops can do this trivially. So we want to see the 19991 triangular number 1 + 1/2, and we get it. And let's see, is it, it's overlapping. But can we see it's the same number? Yeah, so he's right. Good. But we all have calculators, like, at our fingertips, and so this is, you know, trivially unnecessary. The formula encapsulates all this table, you know, so much better that none of us, I mean, this is almost laughable. But it really shouldn't, but I want to pause and think about it a little bit more. I mean, the reason why it was published and the reason why this guy got rich and famous, and he's still getting cited 250 years in the future, which is something we can all, you know, strive for. This calculation, there's a balance between how difficult the calculation is versus how easy it is to look it up in a table, right? And it was clearly thought that although most people who would even buy a book on natural numbers on triangular numbers would be able to multiply those numbers, it takes a while. And if you had to do it in pen and paper, it would take you a while, too. It's easier to look it up. So I want to show you a modern example of this, which is also for the, this is a theorist calculating tables of data for the experimentalist who doesn't want to calculate it themselves. So this is not the most famous, this is not the Park-Taylor paper you know of, if you've only know of one of them. It's from 1985, cross-section for 4 gluon production by glue-glue fusion. So this is a very, very practical calculation. They wanted to calculate 2 gluons coming in, 4 gluons coming out. So it's a 6-particle amplitude. And, of course, that was too hard, so they calculated the leading part, what we now call the maximal helicity violating amplitude. And this was a really, really hard computation. Of course, just like x times x plus 1 over 2, the formula was known to everybody, right? It was just you draw all the Feynman diagrams, add them all up. But there are 220 Feynman diagrams, and there are thousands of terms, and the combinatorics is a mess. And so it took them, the use of several the supercomputing power of Fermilab for quite some time, and they finally got it, and as soon as they got it, they rushed this paper out, so soon they didn't have time to explain any details. And the final amplitude that they write, just the rational function, okay, it starts at page 12, so this is what they're going to define it here with A2 with these six momenta is this matrix times that, where they start giving the coefficients of these matrix, and then some more coefficients, and then they define what these D's are. Right, this is just some rational function. Okay, and they keep going. And so it started at page 12 and ended at page 19. Okay? Of course, the more famous paper is 6 months later, they found out how to write it for all n in one line. But the point of this is that, you know, this was clearly a well-sought paper, and it was rapidly published, rapid publication, because this kind of data was useful to some people, experimentalists, and it quickly led to the theorist, to some really immense theoretical insights. And I wish I could zoom, maybe I can zoom in here. Let's see. Oh, I've got the new Okay. So look at the sentence beginning at furthermore here. So furthermore, I can't read the screen up there. We hope to obtain a simple analytic form of the answer, making our result not only an experimentalist, but also a theorist's delight. Right? So I don't know what they saw in these pages and pages of tabled, you know, functions that made them think that they could simplify this down to anything, but they saw something. And 6 months later, they found what they were looking for, and it absolutely lived up to it. It was a theorist's delight, and sure enough, it's easier to calculate too for an experimentalist. But the Park-Taylor formula we all know and love was not derived; it was guessed and checked that it matched this formula. In their famous paper, they cited their previous calculation and said that it agrees with it. This one was done with Feynman diagrams. Okay, so these kinds of stories are all over the place in the recent, especially in the last 10 years. Almost every kind of calculation, you know, the formulas. Let me make another analogy to the time of Jean Cor here. What was interesting in physics at the time was not, they weren't discovering new laws in the late 18th century. No, what they were doing is they were reformulating the known laws in ways that were more efficient, because it's really, really hard to calculate F equals ma. Of course, you could if you had enough time, but it's much easier. If Newton's laws were just hard to work with, and so the least action principle was a more efficient way of calculating things. But if you asked Euler or Lagrange if they were coming up with some fundamental rephrasing of Newton, they would have said, of course not, because they were proving that it was equivalent to Newton. That was the whole point. It was just a computational toolbox. But of course, from our modern perspective today, it's a much more useful statement of, there isn't a relativistic quantum mechanic, a special relativistic quantum mechanical version of F equals ma, but there is of the least action principle. And so as we go, I think what we're discovering is a new formulation of quantum field theory. We can do it the hard way, but to do it the hard way requires knowing, having some calculators. And so I hope to share those tools with you here. Okay. So I'm really going to start at the bottom. So if you're an expert, just relax, and I hope I can give you some new twists on things you're very familiar with already. And if you're not, I hope to provide illustrative examples of everywhere I can, and hopefully this notebook will be a useful reference for you. Okay, so you all start. So the canonical starting point for any introduction to Mathematica: shift enter. So you type in some formula, and you hit shift enter, just like what we did, in Spotlight when we did one. Exactly the same syntax, exactly the same. Or two. Same calc. Good. So Spotlight and Mathematica agree. And if you want to use Mathematica this way, it works great. But it's a little bit expensive. It might not be worth the money, considering Spotlight and Google will do it for you for free. I just couldn't resist pointing out that this is not actually correct. It's not actually shift enter. It's shift return. If you have an enter key, that works all by itself. The shift makes return into enter. So it's just enter, really. Anyway. On new MacBook Pros, they don't have the enter key anymore, and I was very sad to lose the enter key. So when you hit Shift Enter, the first time you do it, you'll always notice a slight pause. And that slight pause is because it's actually starting up the thing that does all the brains of Mathematica. And you can see that here. I've got all these different possible kernels, and the local one is the one that opened by default. That's usually the one. You probably only have one unless you've set up more. I'll explain why more kernels are useful later. But the first time you open it, it has to load up the whole kernel, which is why it takes a little bit of time. But then every other time, it'll be faster. And notice that in the syntax here, I hope this is it's obviously too small, but you can probably see the little red marks there. And if you have your own computer, or if you look at the printout of this, it says in one equals this and out one equals that. And every line of input that you put, if you write in Mathematica, when you hit enter, it is stored. And a line, I really mean a line, not necessarily an expression. So when we look at this, if we have a bunch of cells, or if we have a cell with a lot of, functions all separated by returns, and hit enter, we evaluate them all at once. But we'd really do it in sequential order. And they each get their own in and out numbers separately, whether or not they're printed to screen. So the first one is in 2, sum from n equals 1 to 19,991. And sure enough, that matches 2. So we can calculate this thing a lot of different ways. 13 is not printed to screen, but it is stored in memory. And Mathematica is filled with lots of standard mathematical functions, like polylogarithms, hypergeometric functions, Fibonacci. If you are familiar with it from popular literature in mathematics, it's in Mathematica. And if you're vaguely familiar, if it's even vaguely relevant to modern research, it's probably somewhere in there. Or there's some add-on you can do that does it. OK, so every single time you hit enter, every line is stored separately. So in one, if we do this, it stores what we saw up there. This is very useful for going back and things. And things, in 100 hasn't happened yet. And so rightfully enough, Mathematica leaves it alone. Whenever it encounters an expression it doesn't know, it's not defined, because we haven't executed the 100th input yet, it just leaves it unevaluated. That is very useful. As we go, you'll see my philosophy is really to leave things as unevaluated as possible. I like to keep Mathematica on a need-to-know basis and not really telling it what it's doing until it needs to. I don't really trust it. OK, so out, basically the same as in, except for that out, you'll notice that, I wish I could zoom in on this, but in has colon equals. I'll explain this in a moment. So it's in something, where it's colon equals, where out, it's just equals. Which means that when you type in one in one, it actually reevaluates it from scratch. Whereas if you type out one, it just recalls the output. Okay, so the function out can also be called by this percent sign, which is very commonly encountered. So this is what? That's the Fibonacci number, the 90th Fibonacci number. And you can write out with square brackets, or you can write percent six, or the line number. Much more common, and I think much more useful, are just the single percent signs. So the single percent sign always refers to the line, the previous line defined. And if you have more and more of them, I think that goes on ad infinitum. It goes back and forth. It goes all the way back to, so 2% signs are 2 lines above, 3 are 3 lines above, et cetera. So let's say we choose some, random is a built-in function. It spits out some number between 0 and 1 by default. And so we get the random number. But 4 lines up was the Fibonacci number. But now if I hit it again, 4 lines up was the previous random. So notice the 0.12 shifted down. And now if we do it again, we'll see that this out 17 is the one that's 4 up. So 3.8, see it's cycling down. OK. So there are a ton of built-in Mathematica functions that are useful. A lot of the ones I'm going to be talking about, I won't have time to give you a full introduction to them. But any kind of introduction that I would give you is really I would be looking it up in the Documentation Center and just, you know, explaining what it does. So the Documentation Center should be your friend, and it's a very, very useful resource. So if you when you look at the notebook, if you download when you download it online, you can just click on the link or hit F1 or go to Help Documentation Center. And in here, you can search for functions directly. So if you wanted to know what random was, it'll tell you this. And it's been superseded by random real and random integer, so you shouldn't use random anymore. Or at least you know, it's frowned upon. It's obsolete in Mathematica, okay, which I didn't know. But you can also get the gist of anything like that by the question mark. So question mark some function will tell you all the details about it. So if you range is a very, very useful function. So if you don't use range all the time, pay close attention because you could. Range is very, very useful. So it just spits out a list from, and if you just say range some number, it makes a list so range 6 gives you a list from 1 to 6. But notice that if you add an extra argument, it changes the meaning of the function altogether, right? So range 6 comma something means from 6 to something. So the first argument, the entire meaning of the first argument changes. And if you add a third argument to it, it skips over 1. So it's 6 for a range from 6 to 10, skipping over by, you know, in units of 2, steps of 2. This is really, really useful. If you ever find yourself thinking that there's a built-in function that you know about that almost does what you want it to do, but not quite, and yet what you want it to do is not absurd, there's a very, very good probability that there's an optional argument for the function that will switch it to do what you want it to do. So another great example of this, and I've seen many people do it, including myself, have defined their own mod function because of the silly thing that when Mathematica by default, mod sets n to 0. Which makes sense, right? So mod, if you look at the range 12, mod 6, see it sets 6 to 0, which is kind of what a mathematician would think of as mod. But we almost never want that. We always want something mod. We always want it to be offset by 1 so that the, like, for example, if we want entries in a list, we want to take it mod the length of the list. But we don't want anything to be in 0. So you know, Zn we think of as 1 through n. So this is very useful. And it's fixed by that single last one. Similarly, another common function that's very useful, random integer. So we need random integers all the time. We need random integers to make the random momentum twisters that Freddie talked about, generate random data. It could be real numbers. It doesn't make any difference. They're all actually structurally the same in this case. So but as a function, random integer all by itself just gives you a number 0 or 1. So it says, see, pseudo-randomly gives 0 or 1. And if you give it an argument, it gives you a random number between 0 and that number. And if you give it a second argument, it gives you n of those numbers. So if you say random integer 50, 10, it's 10 numbers between 0 and 50. And if you give it more, if you give it array, it'll give you a huge random array. So although I've made tables filled with random integers, you can just, you know, random integer all by itself will spit out a table of random integers of any depth or size that you'd like. So there are lots of useful little things. Whenever you think you're doing something annoying or something that's repetitive, it's probably, there's a good chance that somebody else thought it was annoying and also and built it in. So another useful thing about the question mark is that it'll take incomplete functions. So if you just if you add it to the star, it'll search for anything that begins with that. And so, for example, matrix, if we do star, we'll search for, we find that there's a function called matrix exponent. There's a matrix form, matrix plot, matrix power, matrix q. Matrix q is kind of interesting. So it tells you, it sees an expression and spits out true if it's a list of lists. Notice that it doesn't say it's a matrix. It says it's a list of lists. Because a matrix, according to Mathematica, is just a list of lists. There's we'll go into more what Mathematica thinks later at the end of this. And it gives true if it is and false if it isn't. Okay. Now, two question marks gives you a much stronger, gives you a much more complete set of information. So partition is another kind of useful function that you should be familiar with. If you are not familiar with partition, you should look it up. These are like friends that you should become acquainted with in the help in the documentation center if you're not already familiar with them. Because partition does all sorts of really useful things, like for the MHV amplitudes, right? So we want to have all of these things. We want to cycle around and include the N1 at the end. So, for example, partition range, I don't know, 8. If you do 2, it just, you know, skips over 2s. And if you give it the next argument of 1, it does all partitions of 2s separated by 1s. And if you give it the last one of 1, it also gives you the last thing that you want. So these are things that, you know, at first glance, or if you've only seen it a couple times, you might not know how useful it is. But if you read the help file, it's really nice. Okay. And also, the double question mark spits out all possible special values that the function has been defined for. And so, for example, as we've been going, every time we've typed in an expression, we've defined what in is for that number. So we know what in 1 is, what in 2 is. And if we, you know, double question mark in, we'll see those are all the inputs that we've done. Okay? And notice when it chooses to evaluate it. So for example, it didn't really evaluate that. It kind of held it. That's interesting. It held most of them. And it even says the ones that weren't output. Notice it has a semicolon to suppress the output. Okay. So as I've already mentioned, general advice. If you ever find yourself looking for something you think that other people might have been annoyed by, it's probably a better use of your time to look in help than to reinvent the wheel. Okay, so that's just like the basics of just using Mathematica as a straight calculator, just finding the functions in the lookup table, you know, and you know, evaluating various triangular numbers and becoming rich and famous 250 years ago. So just in terms of like day-to-day life, this is something that's it's almost intuitive, but it's really useful. So I thought I'd mention it. If you just like multiple click on an expression, it'll keep highlighting it and it'll stop at all the sub expressions. So notice that if I click here, it'll grab all of that, and then the next time it'll grab the plus 16, and then if I keep going, it'll grab the whole thing. And if I double click there, it grows. So this is an, if you ever find yourself dragging and trying to find the matching parentheses, just click a bunch of times and you'll watch it stop. And similarly, so another useful one, which is acts pretty a little differently, is Command Shift B. And this is probably more useful for proofreading and error, you know, debugging than anything else. But when you hit Control Shift B, it immediately highlights it highlights from where your cursor is to the nearest parentheses or square brackets or anything else that it finds. So, and it always goes outside. So if notice the cursor is here between the square and curved parentheses, right, it's going to go to the outside. And so if you have some very, very long nested expression and you want to see where it began, you can always hit just Control Shift B and it immediately highlights all that. Very useful. Another thing that a lot of very familiar Mathematica users do all the time that probably confuses people, it intimidates people who don't know the commands, are how to get like little pretty forms of input, like for example fractions. And so if you hit control is with the the key for all of these. So if you do, A, B, if you want to get a pretty form of the expression that way. I mean, these are of course not very necessary, you know, in day-to-day life, but they come in handy. So notice that if you let's say I were to just do that at the end, it would just put the denominator below the last part of the expression. But if you have more highlighted, say that, it'll highlight the whole, it always takes whatever's highlighted as the numerator. And all of these things work the same way. So if you want to get like a to the b, or take a square root, square root of 2, okay. We'll even evaluate it. That's easy. Okay, and so, and then this is a, this I copied from the Documentation Center. It's just a complete list of all of the various such shortcut keys. And again, it's another example of where Documentation Center came in handy. Okay. Another useful, just another, this is not useful for programming, but useful for day-to-day life and becoming friends with Mathematica. So you can get special characters by just hitting escape. And when you hit escape, you'll notice that you get this weird three-dotted thing to the side of the cursor. And that's a temporary symbol, and it disappears as soon as you hit escape again. Well, if it's done something. So notice that. Or if we did, you know, H, we get eta. Or G, we get gamma. And these are just regular functions, or regular variables. They're as good as any other letters in the alphabet, and much better than some of them, like I, which you can't use. And here's a complete list of them. So if you want to get like the integral sign, or you want to get an E that's pretty, or the you want to take a gradient with that symbol, you can. Or intersections, or some of these things are usually special characters. The other way to do it is through the palettes, which you can get by going up to Palette Writing Assistant, and you'll find all these little key, you know, all these little special things like exponents and fractions and whatnot here, too. And I think if you hover over it, it'll tell you what to do, too. Yeah. So if you hover over it, it says fraction keyboard entries control slash. And this thing is control six. Six, because six is where the caret is in the keyboard. Okay. So this is the first bit of useful new advice. So alt period aborts an evaluation. And it needs to be a that works most of the time. But it does require that the evaluation is kind of nice when it's screwed up. So for example, if we do an endless loop, like while true A, notice that so on the right-hand side, you can see the little highlighted cell. It's because it's running. It's running, and if you notice, it's using, well, here's my CPU. It's using 100% of my CPU. Just running true, you know, A. And it's waiting for true to be false, but true is never going to be false. And so your options are to restart Mathematica, quit, or something, or you can just hit alt period. So, or command period on a Mac. Okay? And that works great. Another one, which this app is probably more common because it doesn't involve any debugging. It's just kind of, you know, this, yeah.
That a loop is endless?
Well, you'd think, I mean, in this case, you'd think it should, right? I mean, obviously, true is never going to be false. In some cases, it will. So, for example, another kind of infinite loop that you can do is, I'll explain this in a little bit, replace repeated. If you just had a single slash, this takes A and it turns it to B. And if you had two of them, that won't do anything. But if I take A to B and then I send B to A, it'll keep cycling. And if I do that, notice it stopped, and it stopped somewhere on my screen. It's got to be a little message, a little warning message. Sorry. Replace repeated, exiting after 655,000 times. Okay, so it noticed that this thing was getting nowhere, and it quit. But that's really because the replace repeated has a control on it. Same with full simplify and things like that. Sometimes depending on how you configure it, full simplify will occasionally say, I'm giving up on the sub-expression. But this case, it's like this is a pure programmer's problem. Like, yeah.
Actually, the task of deciding if a program is going to stop or not is undecidable. So yeah. It's just a theoretical computer science way to answering the question to no.
No, exactly. I mean, it's although it is easily decidable in this case, it's generally not, right? There's no general algorithm to decide. So so you have the two options. You can either, like, itemize all the cases you can do, which gets most of it done maybe, but it's going to be a mess, or you just give up. Another thing that happens all the time, and this one's much more common, I think, is where you do like full simplify, and full simplify is just cranking. And if it's still running, you're kind of confident because it's doing something, right? Full simplify would give up if it wasn't doing something. I mean, it runs until it simplifies, until there are no more sub-expressions that can be simplified. But that can really be interminable, especially if you have some very horrendous expression. And so if you did full simplify on accident and it's been 10 minutes and you're going to give up, you know, just abort. And you won't lose anything. And if this alt or command enter or command period doesn't work, the next safest thing to do is to go to evaluation and quit kernel local, or whichever kernel is running. And that will be a hard kill, but it's still relatively safe because Mathematica is doing it. If that doesn't work, you should kill it using system activity monitor or something and quit process, you know, and force it. But as soon as you get into, like, that regime where you're really forcing it with a hard kill, beware of the red interrupted of death. I've interacted with Wolfram about this, and it is a bug introduced in Mathematica 7 that has not been unintroduced because I've encountered it about 5 times since Mathematica 8's come out. And so this is really pleasant, so I'll explain it. Sometimes when you have a really hard crash and you kill the kernel, Mathematica has this tendency to overwrite the expression that was being evaluated, which might be, you know, 100 lines of code, or it might be, you know, some huge nested thing of equations, and it'll replace all of that with interrupted. That's on it. So whenever you do a hard restart like that, make sure you don't have any interrupteds, or else don't save it, because if you save it, you'll lose all your code. And it'll overwrite it, so you might think, oh, I should save it to be safe, but no, this will then, you know, ruin it. My first implementation of BCFW was a tragedy of interrupted. Ran overnight, and I got up to 9.n² MHV, you know, hardcore, and using Momenta, 4 Momenta, and then I stopped it, and I lost, you know, like a week's worth of work, because I saved it. Don't save it. Oh, okay. Yeah, and that's actually it's a bug. It's not supposed to be there. Okay, so defining functions. So everybody's probably familiar with this in some level, but there are some subtleties that are really worth drawing out. So I'm going to do this in a little bit more detail than you might expect. So the way that most people would probably do this is, you know, something equals something else. You can say my function x is valued at y, or you can say maybe I can't really define x equals 1 because, well, but people do this. No, I can't do it. Sorry. I have a thing against defining local variables that are small like that. It's like dangerous. Okay, so but my function of x we've defined to be y, and we haven't defined it for 1, we haven't defined it for capital X, we've only defined it for little x. Okay, so clearly if you evaluate all these things, it leaves it unevaluated if it doesn't know what it is. So it's important, it's useful to know that what Mathematica does when you do this, when you evaluate this function, you're actually calling another function called set, which sets the right-hand side to be, sets the left-hand side to be the right-hand side in Mathematica's global memory of rules. So whenever it finds my function of x, it evaluates the right, it spits out the right-hand side. And it when we call it in this way, it's also evaluating the right-hand side initially. So let's see some more, some non-trivial examples of that. This is probably something you've, if you have any experience with Mathematica, you're probably more familiar with this frame, this form of it, because we don't usually define a function for a particular value, because the particular value is as good as the function then, if you're going to do it one at a time. And so when you define it this way, you say f of x underscore this. Now, let's just break this expression apart. The important part of this expression is the underscore. See, what it, because the underscore is a huge important thing in Mathematica. This is, it's the first example we've seen so far of a pattern, and it's a pattern called blank. It has a name. It's the function blank. You can blank. It spits out that underscore. Okay? And it is, it stands for anything whatsoever, anything of any depth, of any complexity, whatever, as long as it's one unit, so as long as it's one object. So it can be arbitrarily nested things, you know, whatever. It can be arbitrarily complicated, but it's just one thing. It's exactly one. We'll see that there are blanks that can be arbitrary, you know, have different lengths, but that. And so that's the important operative thing. And the x is only there to say what that blank is called. So a blank just means any single expression whatsoever, and x underscore means any single expression whatsoever, which we're going to call x in the right-hand side. So this, so it can be, you know, you can misuse all sorts of notation and it will still work. So for example, if you define, let's say, triangular numbers, so now we want to reproduce those tables and go back in time and become rich and famous, we can just evaluate it and it's replacing the symbol x. It's replacing this, this everywhere on the right-hand side you see x, it's replacing it with whatever you put inside there. And you could even put in really weird things, like, let's see, like list. What is that going to do? Oh, it did something. Did something because adding one to a list makes sense. It makes, it takes 1, 2, 3 and makes it, you know, 2, 3, 4. And multiplying two lists, Mathematica, that's a little more subtle. But when it's just a space like that, it's an outer product over 2. So, okay. This means that actually triangular number is a nice listable thing. We can do, like, wow, this is great. It's going to make our table making easy. If I want to get the first 10 triangular numbers, I just evaluate it on list. Okay. But we can do anything else. I mean, if we did f of 10, it would just spit out that. Okay. And one of the things that's important is that the right-hand side, when we define a function using f, set is this pattern, this thing with the equal sign in the middle, you immediately evaluate both the right-hand side and the left-hand side. So what it does is it takes the right-hand side as you've given it as a symbolic expression, which is, you know, it doesn't, it's going to need to stand for whatever x could ever be. This is usually why it's not very good to define functions this way, because usually you're not very careful about, like, let's say you need to have a, maybe x is supposed to be a matrix, and you're going to have matrix multiplication in there. Well, matrix multiplication doesn't work very good on symbols. It works good on lists. So if you defined a function immediately, it would screw up. Anyway, I'm going to advocate the general philosophy of whenever you have an opportunity to, you know, keep Mathematica in ignorance, you should do it. It's almost always better to delay evaluations. So we can do the same function, but use this colon equals. In Mathematica, this is done with the colon equals sign. And colon equals means define a rule for the left-hand side. So replace the left-hand side with the right-hand side whenever you encounter it, but don't evaluate the right-hand side until that happens. So x is, notice that here on the right-hand side, x is green, whereas when we defined it up here, it's blue. Mathematica is kind of clever about coloring these days. And so that means that x is going to be this abstract symbol. It's whatever it needs to be on the right-hand side. Whereas here, it's really treated like some parameter called x. Okay. And so we're going to define it the same way as the function above, only we're going to have it print out the x triangular number has been computed when it's called. And it says, okay, the 19991 triangular number has been computed, the pith triangular number has been computed, and I bet you if it'll tell us that, like, the list 10, you know, that triangular number has been computed, okay? But it's evaluated afresh every single time, and if you reevaluate it, it redoes that, it re-spits that out every time. Whereas the previous example, when we defined it this way, it defines, so it says the xth triangular number has been computed. Well, we haven't even given it an x yet, right? So why did it spit that out? Well, it spit it out because it evaluated the right-hand side on the first try. And it doesn't give you the message for any of these. So this is useful for store, because, so people have different philosophies about this. But on the one hand, set without the colon equals, you know, just equals, immediately puts something in memory and makes it very fast to look up. And so those things are, it's like cached. So if you have a complicated function, you only need to do it once. And then it's done once and for all for everything. So it can be more efficient that way. Whereas the delayed one, you have to reevaluate it every time. And so that's a little, a little slow. But I think you can always, you'll never go wrong if you use the delayed equals. And if you want to get the best of both worlds, you can do a delayed and set way. So this is, if you haven't seen this before, this is a really useful trick. It's how to get a function to remember the value that it's evaluated. So if you use colon equals, this delayed one, and then the equal sign, notice that the set delayed calls set. So the first time you call it, it evaluates the right-hand side for the first time ever. So it's going to evaluate this for the first time ever when it's been called. But that defines it once and for all forever. So for example, I prefer Mathematica to not know what the number stored is and write that out. Okay. So if we evaluate the triangular number, this thing, it tells you that it was evaluated once, and it evaluates it then, but it doesn't reevaluate it. This is really useful, like when we get to the tree amplitudes, we're going to have long functions of many brackets, for example. And doing this can speed you up by many factors of 10. Well, not too many, but a few. Because instead of reevaluating the same objects many, many times, you can just evaluate them once and remember them. Notice that if we look for the definition, we use the question mark works on your functions just as well as it does on Mathematica's. And so if you look for it, it says that triangle number stored, it is defined for 691, for 19991, but for anything else, it's defined the way we defined it. And Mathematica has this priority list. It's listing it in the order of priority, which means that and the way Mathematica thinks, it finds your expression, and every time it sees a sub-expression, it looks through a long, long list of all of its internally defined functions and all the functions you've ever defined, and it finds whether or not it can replace something. If it can, it does. And even if you've defined it multiple times, like, for example, if you asked it for the triangular number stored 691, it's defined twice because this one works just as well as this. But the first one occurs first. It's going to spit that out. This is useful, by the way, because another thing that happens all the time, like let's say you have, so you're looking for some alternating helicity amplitude or something, right? And you want to just change all the minuses to plus and all the pluses to minuses, or I don't know, I'm just giving some pattern here. So you want to change P to M and you want to change M to P. Is this dangerous? No, it works perfectly. And the reason why is because when it encounters M, the only rule that applies is this one. So it applies it. It changes it into P. And when it encounters P, it applies this one. So it keeps going. Only if I asked it to do it again and again would it, get that infinite loop problem. But replacement rules like that work. It just looks through the list, finds the first thing it can use. Okay. Now, this is also a common notation, but pretty irregular. So another way to define functions altogether, and this is an extremely useful and flexible way of defining things, anyway, I tend not to use that much. Instead of saying some function of x is equal to this, you can just write the function that you want in terms of x and just replace x everywhere with something. And this just takes the left-hand side and every time it sees x, it puts in this number. And similarly with set and set flayed, there's another version of set which surprisingly very few people ever encounter, or I rarely see in other people's code, which is the colon equals, or colon arrow. So you can, instead of this thing, you can do, instead of that thing. And that thing turns into a funny looking arrow when you hit space. Okay, so if you've ever seen this thing is the relationship between this normal arrow and the colon arrow is the exact same as between equals and colon equals. One is delayed. And this is why I almost always use the colon arrow, even though it's not strictly necessary most of the time. But I like to use the colon arrow because I want to treat the right-hand side of the replacement as some abstract function. And I want it to be as flexible as possible. But that. OK, so I don't have much. How much more time? Oh, great. OK, so so while we're on the you know, getting familiarized, one of the things that you should all be doing around now for at least to gain background and check things for these talks are using packages. And using packages are very simple. For example, I'm going to advertise a little bit. So for example, there's a publicly available package you can download off. It's on the archive. BCFW, and it immediately calculates all the tree amplitudes and Yang mills. Like I said, it does it 10,000 times slower than what I'm going to explain in 2 days, but it does work pretty well, and it's a good error. It's a good thing to debug. So if you want the alternating helicity amplitude for 6 particles, you can just ask it, and it just spits it right out. Right. So these functions are of course also defined by it, and you can evaluate it. Like let's say you want to know the alternating 10-point n cubed MHV amplitude. Okay, that's what it is. All right, what are my variables? My twisters are those things. My lambdas are, and my lambda bars are those. I don't really want to give any tutorial on how to use a package, or especially my own. I'd much rather explain how to build your own from scratch, because you learn much more, and it's just much much better for everyone if you do this stuff yourself. And I think I can do it in a few minutes. So notice what it's doing here. It's calculating the BCFW formula, the formula for the 10-point n cubed MHV amplitude, which is one that we're going to calculate. It should be somewhere like 10 minutes into lecture three, because it will go really quickly. It's 175 terms. So those are the 175 terms. And if we add them all up, let's make it so we can see. So we add up all those 175 terms. It's okay. It equals n amp. Good self-consistency, and it's took 1 millisecond. Okay, but we can. But one of the features that I put into the BCFW package for no particularly good reason is that it can also do the recursions in lots of different ways, lots of permutations. And so another set of BCFW terms we could have gotten. Let's see what they look like. They look like this instead of the other ones. And if you notice that it has there's the intersection between those terms and the first terms are zero. So there's 175 terms add up to this right answer, and then another 175 terms add up to this right answer, and they're totally different. Not a single one between them. You have a big 350-term identity between rational functions. And the 6-term identity for NMHB can easily take you an entire Saturday. So this one is pretty hard. But it's the kind of relationships that you get between these rational functions that are useful to check. For one thing, it's a fantastic consistency check. In order for you to get these 175, two sets of 175 functions to evaluate perfectly, you're also seeing an advantage of using integers instead of, or rational numbers instead of real numbers. We have infinite precision cancellation there. And if we were to pick random variables, it wouldn't make any difference. So, it's going to take longer. So if you wanted to, do this for, okay, total. So now that's what the function looks like. Let's see what it, and we'll see that, okay, good, those things add up. They should. And if we do it tier 2, we see it's that huge mess. nothing intersecting, and okay, those two numbers are equal, right? Okay. That is an infinite precision verification that those two formulas are the same. Okay. But there are lots of other packages that you can use that are very useful. For example, the Mellon-Barnes package, which I know Johannes is going to be, well, is going to make use of. But there are, these are a lot of nice tools available online. But a really useful, like, life skill for Mathematica is to create your own packages. So if you've never done this before, it's very easy, and it's all you have, just have to go to File, New, Package, okay? And you say, begin. I'll put this example up with the notebook so you can see it. But, I mean, like, my package. And you just have, there's a little syntax that's a little weird, but, oh, sorry, I need to. I don't start these very often. So this is the syntax that you need. End package, and that has to follow end because it's ending the global. Okay. So if you define this and save it in some notebook in some place, like I'd put it in Amplitudes or in the Mathematica School here, I'd say, you know, like my package. What's useful about this is that this gives you a repository for you to put all the functions that you are using on a day-to-day basis. So as you're building up some, you know, as you're doing some difficult calculation, it's useful to take all the subparts that are transferable and putting it somewhere so you can use it later. And so just as a random, like, subset of things, you know, my day-to-day work these days, I have a little package called Amplitudes. It's not publicly available. Not going to get it. But it does things like, for example, the three-loop integrand seeds. You want to know what the five-term three-loop amplitude is, or the six-point three-loop amplitude. The time is not for generating the list. It's for deleting all the cyclic classes of them. So this is just translating that formula into some symbols, right? So the triple hexagon is just that symbol, whatever it is in the paper. And, of course, every one of those things has a concrete meaning. You know, so that's what they mean. They mean that means the first triple hexagon means that rational function. And, oh, okay, that thing didn't work. But, okay. You know, we all have bugs. But similarly, you know, like if you want to know the 2,327 coefficients to the 7-loop amplitude, you can, you know, that's what they are. Or 2,329, sorry. There are 2,329 planar 7-point dual conformal invariant graphs, and those are the coefficients that give you the amplitude. Okay, and if you want to, like, graph them, if you ever need to write a paper and have these graphs appear, Mathematica is really good at doing tedious stuff. Consider it your graduate student. Okay, and just one last little comment. When you make your own package, you want to be able to call it. And if you've noticed that when I've called these packages here, I haven't referred to them as living anywhere in the computer. And the reason is because I put them all in a very nice directory, which I will show you. If you go to your user thing and go to whatever computer you have, whatever architecture, you go to your personal part, and then you go to library. Why is that? Oh, yeah, they hid it in this new. I have a new version of I'll show you where it is. I have a link. Okay. So wherever we are here. So it's in your user's library, Mathematica applications. If you put anything in there, it'll be found immediately. And or you can just add a path to the, you can use options to add a path. But anyway, this is very useful. So you can just store something there, and you can call it up whenever you start. I've only got a couple minutes, or not really. I'll just show you some random, you know, fireworks kind of, oh, well, that's not going to work very well either. But, you know, Mathematica, there's some, I think very visually, and so I use Mathematica a lot to think about, okay, so this is an F, this is a local model in F theory, and you see these pictures drawn in papers all the time. What it means is that when you move over the plane, the C2 plane, there are these fibers that live over here, that are over here, and there are two cycles in them that grow and shrink. And when they shrink, you get extra gauge grooves. So there you get E6 cross SU2 cross U1, and there's E7 and whatnot. But then you can also take a slice of that construction and and you get, you know, these are the radii as you move across this line, okay, and all the little vertices are the locations of matter fields, and it doesn't look like any of my other things are gonna. Let's see, maybe that's gonna. Oh, I can do that. Okay. Good, good. So these are just some nice, like, showy graphics that I like. So if you want to build, I used to do a lot of model theory and model building in M theory and F theory. So you can, you know, take these models and break them apart. This one gives one that's remarkably close to the standard model. It's kind of nice. And you can also, in M theory, it's more three-dimensional. So you want to take a point and you want to break it apart into a bunch of little isolated local singularities. You want to break them apart again, and you want to break them apart again. And all of the superpotential terms come up with these. They all lie in straight lines in space. And you can screw around with the moduli and, you know, change how long the lines are, which is what's going to determine the strength and the superpotential. And at the end of the day, if you want to, like, you know, do all the group theory and all the stuff about all, you know, change all the fluxes and arbitrary combinations and see which kinds of fields you get, you can do that too. So here's all possible M theory models coming from E8, for example. You can sit. So the top row is what fields you want projected out. If you want to, if you click that, it recalculates the spectrum of matter, tells you you have an anomaly, calculates all the new superpotential terms, tells you what the massless modes are, what the field combinations. The second line does all the, you can arbitrarily conjugate any field. Okay, so these are all really, these are calculations that people usually do by hand that take forever. Every time you pick some, you set of fluxes, you have to, you get a new spectrum of matter, and it's, but it's always trivial, right? If you know this, if you know all the Yukawa, if you know all the charges, you just spit out the Yukawa coupling. But, and it's just tedious. And if, whenever you come up with a tedious calculation, you should ask Mathematica to do it, because it'll do it quickly, and immediately it lets you explore a very large fraction, you know, class of models, and just some prettier plots before I go. So I'll get into the next, to Mathematica vernacular next time. 5 minutes. Great. Okay, so, you know, anyway, some nice plots. Okay. So I've loaded up a ton of junk in memory. I'll make that up. Okay, so I think it might be a better idea just to postpone this to the next time where I'm doing more abstract things. Later this afternoon, there's going to be a problem session, and I'll be around. And, you know, this is a lot of the things, like, I'm not going to have any time to explain how to do manipulates or whatnot. These are all things that you can learn from the Documentation Center just by reading it and seeing all the examples that they have. But I certainly have, you know, wasted. It's like LaTeX. You know, you want to do something complicated, you have to look it up. It takes you 10 times longer than you wanted the first time. But once you've learned it, it's really easy. Anyway, so I've got a lot of that kind of knowledge that was waste. You know, it only feels worthwhile if I share it. Otherwise, if there are any questions or no. Okay. Thank you.